Well, good to see everyone this morning. We are in Philippians 4, and we're finishing off the series, not today, but next week. So we're kind of just hitting the tail end. And today I'm going to be preaching on Philippians 4, verses 8 and 9. Originally, probably you saw in the email, it was Philippians 4, verses 8 to 10. But kind of 11 to 20 is kind of its own section. So I decided just to preach on verses 8 and 9 this morning. You know, as a church, we're a church that values dialogue. And so I just want to say, if there's something I say that's maybe a little odd or confusing or maybe interesting, or even if you disagree with what I say, you're always welcome to come and talk to me. I know that no one ever disagrees with anything I say. I know it's just perfect and you just love it all. You just love it. You disagree with me all the time. I know it. But I just want to say you're always welcome to share. You know, I would say as a pastor, actually, if you're reading scripture and engaging, and you never disagree with me, that would be a problem, because that would mean that your faith hasn't become your own. You know, we have to own our own faith. I can't live your Christian life for you. You can't live your Christian life for someone else. It's something that we all have to live. Now, obviously, we do this in community, but part of what we'll be talking about today is that we are required to think about the scriptures, to struggle with it, to wrestle with it for ourselves. Have you ever navigated something that was maybe a bit confusing or perplexing? Something maybe you weren't confident about? A good example is Starbucks. So, you all know where I'm going. So, if you know Starbucks, you know that there's probably about 50 different extras or additions or alterations, whatever you want to call it, you can do to your drink. And this is something I am not confident about. Now, Yvette enjoys Starbucks. I was going to say that she loves Starbucks, but she corrected me when I was telling her my sermon. She says, you know, I enjoy the drinks, but I hate the price. And so that's, she very much doesn't like to spend money. And so she hates the price of Starbucks. But if you know, if you're a Starbucks member, you can go on your birthday and you can get a free drink. So on Yvette's birthday, we always go to Starbucks to get a free drink. And Yvette's goal, when she goes to Starbucks to get her free drink, is to get the most expensive drink possible with all the different alterations and additions and whatever you want to name it. And usually when we go there, she prepares beforehand for the order. Like usually when we're driving there, she's on her phone and she's seeing all the different things she can do. And she'll go order the drink. And then the receipt will come back, and the receipt is like a foot long, you know, for a Starbucks drink with all the different additions and different things like that. And, you know, it's great, and, you know, I appreciate that. But if you were to ask me to do that, I would be completely hopeless. You know, and when it's my birthday, we also go to Starbucks, but then she orders the drink, and, you know, same kind of deal. We do it again, just because we love free stuff. And so, I mean, who doesn't? But, you know, some of things are really difficult to navigate, to figure out. I mean, even we can talk about taxes and we can groan about taxes. But, you know, to be honest, you know, like I've often filed my taxes online. Yvette's mom is an accountant, and so she does it for us, which is even better. But even when I would do it online, it'd still be a bit complicated. And I remember when I became a sole proprietor, I'm not sure if I'm saying that right, but for the CRA, that's essentially when you own your own business and you're working for yourself. And I just remember being so confused about the taxes and how to do everything right. And I could only imagine if I was a boss who had lots of employees, just how much of a pain that would be. And I guess that's why businesses have accountants, because it's a real pain. You know, some things are hard to navigate, to know what we're doing with. I mean, I remember when I was a teenager, that it was hard sometimes to navigate the roads. We didn't have GPSs. For you teenagers in here, young whippersnappers, GPSs weren't really a thing. And when I was a teenager, they were just kind of coming out. Now, could you imagine trying to go, say, to like the middle of Toronto without a GPS? I mean, maybe some of you older people might know Toronto really well, but I can't imagine trying to figure out an address to a house without a GPS. I would just be hopelessly lost. And just using a map, well, no one uses maps anymore, and that would be a pain. But anyways, I remember as a teenager that GPSs were just becoming a thing. Around, I think I was around age 16 or 17, I remember them coming out, and they weren't free. You know, like we have Google Maps today, it's free, it's great. But you had to pay for the GPS, and you had to pay for the map updates, and you just had to pay for everything. That's just how it worked. But I was lucky as a teenager that I lived in Edmonton. Edmonton's a newer city and the roads are more grid-like. Because of that, right, like your streets just run north and south and your avenues run east and west. And the nice thing about that is as you go north, the avenues get bigger. And as you go west, the streets get bigger. And so you can kind of just figure out the numbers. It's like, oh, I'm on 156th Street. I need to go to 70th Ave. And you can kind of figure it out in your head where you're going. And so for the most part, that's easy. But when I was a teenager, there was a time where there was something, a place that I had to get to that was really stressful. Now, the reason for that is there's a river called the North Saskatchewan River that goes directly through Edmonton. Now, the North Saskatchewan River flows, let me just get this right, southwest to northeast, and it kind of goes diagonally through the city, and it kind of weaves up and down. It kind of goes through the city like that. And so if you end up having to go to an address that's, say, near the river, sometimes, if back then when I was a teenager, you weren't always sure what side of the river it was on unless you had a map. But me being a teenager, I didn't have a map. And, you know, I mean, I was fairly confident driving around the city because the city, for the most part, worked fairly easily. If you knew the big roads, you knew the names, most of the time you could just figure it out. But my boss that day had said, meet me at this address because we're going to start working on this site. I'm just thinking, I don't have a map. And I know that's right near the river. And I have not sure what side of the river it is on. And in Edmonton, there's not like tons of bridges over the river. There's probably, if I can think off the top of my head, probably like four or five, but those are spaced out. So, I mean, if you go over a bridge and then you got to get back, then it's a real pain. And so I remember thinking like, oh, like, where is this location? And so that was something that was stressful for me. And so basically kind of had to think it through and think, okay, where could this place be? And what side is on the north side of the river and the south side of the river? How am I supposed to get there? And so I thought and thought, and I was trying to recall the memory and thinking like, I think I've been here before. Maybe we've done work here before. And so as I was thinking, eventually I guesstimated. You know, it's kind of a, you know, you're taking a guess slash, you're trying to put your mind into it. And thankfully, I made the right call. But it was a stressful situation because I wanted to get there on time and meet my boss at the right site. When we follow Jesus, we come into situations like this. Let's be honest. A lot of life is lived in the gray. Jesus doesn't oftentimes give us the answers. Sometimes we're praying for healing, and we don't know if that person will get healed. Sometimes we're trying to navigate a difficult family situation and God doesn't show up and say, you need to do this. That doesn't usually happen. And in those difficult situations, God calls us often to rely on him, but relying on God doesn't mean turning our brains off. I sometimes feel like when people say, just rely on God or have faith, and sometimes the implication is, well, stop using your head. But the fact is, God gave us this thing between our ears called our brain for a reason. He's called us to use it. That's part of being a Christian. Now, obviously, I believe there's principles of Scripture. I believe in listening to the Holy Spirit. I believe in listening to other Christians, talking with them, sharing our burdens, but sometimes people don't know the answers. I don't want to be too harsh here, but I've heard Christians that I know, when I was in church, when someone was sick with cancer, saying, this person is going to be healed from cancer. And what happens? That person dies. And what happens after that? Everyone's hurt because they thought God was going to do something, but he didn't. And I'm not saying that those people were trying to deceive. I don't think they were at all. I think they were truly feeling and saying what they thought God was going to do. And I think we need to have faith for healing, but we also have to remember that part of being a Christian means using our minds and thinking through things deeply. I mean, God doesn't tell us whether to buy Toyota or Ford. I'm with the Toyota person even, but I mean, that's just me. God doesn't tell us to buy an Apple or an Android. God doesn't tell us a lot of different things. And sometimes we wish he would. Let's be honest. I wish God would tell me, hey, Stephen, I want you to say this when you're preaching on Sunday. Sometimes I pray, Lord, will you like show me what I should say? And that's a good thing, but he often doesn't say, here's this whole sermon, Stephen, just write it down and then just say it on Sunday. That's not how God often speaks to me. And it's hard. But can you imagine if you're a parent and you have a kid and they're growing up? Can you imagine my little Noah? Every time Noah asks me a question or asks me to help him with a task, I just go ahead and do it for him or just give him the answer every single time. What is that going to do to my Noah when he's an adult and he has to go into the real world? all of a sudden, he can't do anything because I've done it all for him. Part of being a good parent is saying, I'm going to let you fail. I'm going to let you try and figure it out. It doesn't mean that I'm not there to help Noah or to give him advice or to help shape his decision, but as he gets older and older and older, I'm going to have to allow him to make more and more decisions. Otherwise, he cannot grow into maturity. In Philippians 4, 8, and 9, you can go there now. I believe Paul is calling the church to maturity. Maturity is difficult. Let's be honest. I'm sure if all of you can look back on this last week, you can see times where you weren't the person you wanted to be. I can see times this last week when I wasn't the husband, I wasn't the pastor, I wasn't the friend that I want to be. I can see places where I wasn't living fully into the call of Jesus. And obviously, there's always grace for that, and God always has grace for us, but there is this call to mature. And we need to remember here the context of this Philippians. Life was difficult for them. And it's in the difficulties where whether or not we can choose to mature. Because let's be honest, when things are easy, you don't really need to make a choice to grow up, right? Like if your parents are giving you everything, if you're a young kid and you ask for something and your parents just give you money for something, that never forces you to actually go out and seek it on your own. And here the Philippians, they're going through difficulty. They're living in a Roman colony that worships Caesar as Lord. They were in a culture where they would have stood out. Now, we live in a culture where our life is very private. When I go home, 99% of you don't know what I do at home unless you're a friend of mine, you come over. Like, you have no idea what I do at home. But if you lived in the Roman world, their communities were much smaller. Their houses were basically joined to one another. You walked everywhere pretty much unless you're rich. And so you got to see into each other's life a lot more than we do here. And so these Philippians that are following Jesus, they would get seen a lot more because in the Roman world, you would offer sacrifices to the emperor. You participate in rituals. You go to festivals. And if you're a Christian, well, you can't do those things any longer. And so it becomes really easy to stand out, and not even on purpose. It's not like these Christians were probably trying to make life difficult for themselves, but just by following Jesus, all of a sudden things become more difficult. And so this is what Paul is calling us to. He's calling us to maturity in Philippians 4, 8, and 9. So we'll start with verse 8. Finally, brothers and sisters, whatever is true, whatever is worthy of respect, whatever is just, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is commendable, if something is excellent or praiseworthy, think about these things. My first point for this morning is that maturity requires thoughtfulness. Maturity requires thoughtfulness. Now, when I say thoughtfulness, I'm not necessarily thinking of when someone is kind with intention. I'm not saying that's bad. I think that's really good when we're kind with intention, but that's not what I'm trying to say here. Thoughtfulness, as I would define it, or the Cambridge Dictionary, I should say, defines it as the state of thinking carefully about something. And so when I'm talking about thoughtfulness, I'm talking about using our mind to think critically and deeply with intention. Paul is reminding the Philippians here to set their mind on these things in verse 8, in this last section of the verse, to think. Maybe your translation says something like dwell. This idea to ponder, to think deeply, to take some time. Now, if you're a Christian, then you've probably quite familiar with this verse. I went to a Christian school. I'm pretty sure that I memorized this verse. And this is a wonderful verse to dwell on and think about, but sometimes familiarity can actually be something that stops us from thinking deeply. There's more than meets the eye that's going on with this verse. Paul here lists 8 virtues, and this bears a striking similarity to a list of virtues in the Roman world. One scholar puts it this way. It's almost as if he had taken a list from a textbook of ethical instructions and made it his own. Paul is speaking in very Roman language to the Philippians, language that they would have been familiar with. For example, Plato, Aristotle, the Stoics, they all talked about the virtues. This was lists that they would have and that they would call for people to follow. To be a good Roman citizen meant that you lived according to the virtues. Homer, who was a Greek poet and writer in the ancient world, said this, "To have virtues means one who upholds the customs and norms of behavior, including especially public services that make for a well-ordered civilized society. Paul is using the culture of the Romans to communicate about the virtues of things to think and dwell upon. Paul is saying, this is something good about your culture. Paul is not someone who just simply rejects everything of the Roman world, but he's taking the things which are good, and he's saying, let's think about these things deeply. This is what Ben Witherington says in his commentary. Paul is calling his audience to be sifters, not simply rejectors of the larger culture and its values and virtues. Paul believes his audience is capable of making sound moral judgments on their own, and he's trying to train them to have critical tools by providing good examples. If they have the mindset and values of Christ, Paul, and other good examples, they should be able to make wise Christian choices without having a rule for every occasion. What is he talking about here? He's talking about maturity. As Christians, part of our walk with Jesus is growing in our ability to think and engage and to see the good in our culture. I'm not sure if you've felt this. I feel like there's two temptations in our Christianity sometimes when it comes to culture. There's one temptation to reject it all, and there's one temptation to embrace it all. But embracing and rejecting everything does not show maturity. It doesn't show deep thinking. It's very easy just to say, oh, that's all bad or that's all good. But often we know that's not the case. I'm not sure about your upbringing, but my church upbringing, lovely people, but often things that get hyper-spiritualized, almost like that there was a demon behind every corner. I'm not sure if that's something you experienced, but whether it ranged from Pokemon cards to Simpsons to pretty much everything had a demonic influence. And obviously these people loved Jesus, and I don't mean to belittle it because they really did love Jesus. But when you begin to label everything as demonic, nothing becomes demonic. Why? Because you cheapen the word, because you're using it for everything. It loses its value. And obviously I as a pastor believe in demons, I believe in the spiritual world, but when you begin just to label everything as evil, all of a sudden, well, then nothing's evil, because if everything's evil, then what in the world can I actually do? It's very easy to grow up in that culture of fear. And Paul here is speaking to a church in a Roman colony, to a culture, a Roman culture that's very pagan, that worships Caesar as Lord, and yet Paul can still see the good in that culture. I think God wants us to wisely engage and see the good in our culture. It's so easy to see the bad. I get it. There's things that we disagree with, maybe things that irk us, things that make us angry, but it doesn't mean that there isn't good in our culture. And there is good because every person, whether they're a believer or not, are made in the image of Jesus. And people made in the image of Jesus, yes, there's sin in their lives, just as there's sin in our lives, will still reflect goodness. Yes, we still sometimes reflect sin, but still God's goodness is still at work in every person because they're made in the image of God. And Paul is saying, look at that which is good. Hold on to the good. Think of the good. Dwell on the good. Now, there is a flip side here, and Paul's not really talking about it, but I should mention it. I think sometimes we can embrace too much of the culture. Sometimes we can embrace things that aren't helpful, things that we sometimes consume. Sometimes because people like me who maybe grew up in a very legalistic environment or a very kind of hyper-spiritual environment, you can kind of just throw that all out and just embrace everything. And that's not good either. God calls us to use our minds. You know, I'll be very honest. Sometimes I'm worried about the things that we consume, some of the medias, the movies, the music. You know, when I was a youth pastor many years ago in my early 20s, I remember I was at a Christian camp, and some parents had invited me to watch a movie with them. They were watching it with youth from my church, and I can't honestly remember what the movie was or what was in the movie, but I remember thinking, I was really disturbed that the teenagers were watching this movie. And I was just thinking, like, oh, like, this movie isn't good. I think it was just very hypersexual, if I'm remembering correctly. And I just thought, like, this isn't something that they should be consuming. And God calls us to use our minds. Now, I'm not saying that every time you watch a movie or listen to something that's maybe not in alignment with the kingdom of God, you're going to be possessed by a demon. Please, that's not what I'm saying. But I'm saying when we consume those things over time, they do affect us. You know, what we put in our bodies, just like food, affects us over time. If you eat a lot of candy, which sometimes I do, I feel really horrible the next day. You know, and it's the same things with the things we consume. And so we need to practice wisdom. Now, I'm not saying that we can't watch things that aren't PG. I'm not saying that at all. In fact, one of my favorite movies is called Gran Torino. And I'm not sure if you've seen that movie, but there's a lot of swearing. There's racial epithets. It's not a PG movie at all, but that movie, in my opinion, orientates towards the good because it shows a man who overcomes racism, shows a man who chooses to sacrifice. It shows people coming together. You know, sometimes Christians want to keep things PG, but if you read the Bible, you'll know that the Bible is not PG. You know, like the Bible has violence. It has all kinds of things in it that are not what you would necessarily show your kids. I mean, even the Book of Solomon, the rabbis would not let young boys read the Book of Solomon. They had to become men before they could read that book. And so, you know, it's not necessarily, oh, it has this thing in it and we can't watch it. But the question is, what are these things orientating us to? What are they glorifying? What are they trying to teach us? And so Paul here is wanting the Philippians to have maturity, to think and dwell on the things that are good in their culture, the virtues. Let's go to Philippians 4:9. And Paul wants them to think of these virtues so that they can act in a way that is honorable and right. And this is what Paul says in Philippians 4, verses 9. And what you learned and received and heard and saw in me, do these things, and the God of peace will be with you. You know, I love the pairing of these two verses. I'm not sure if Paul did it purposely. He probably did. I mean, I can't read his mind, but I assume he did. One verse, he's talking about thinking, and then the next verse, he's talking about doing. Thinking and doing are supposed to go together. We need both. If you just think without doing, well, then nothing ever happens. And if you do without thinking, well, then sometimes really stupid things can happen. And so you really need both things together when we act, as thinking and doing are meant to go together. We need them. Now, when Paul talks about learning about what they've received, he's probably talking about the apostles' teachings of Jesus from the Gospels. Sometimes we think about when Paul went to these places, what was he teaching them? Well, these believers, these Gentile Roman believers, they wouldn't have had any training in the Old Testament. There was no synagogue in Philippi, so even if they wanted to access the Torah, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, they wouldn't be even able to access it because, well, they're Gentiles, and there's also no synagogue available for them. And so when Paul here is teaching, he's teaching them about Jesus. I'm sure he probably taught them some things about the Old Testament just to help them, but mostly here, Paul is just most likely talking to them about Jesus. He's getting them to center their lives on Jesus. Jesus is such a good place to start. It's very interesting. We can get caught up into debates. I was talking with someone, and they brought up Calvinism versus Arminianism and free will and determination and all those things. And I'm always up for those kind of conversations. But really, what does it matter if we're not centered on Jesus? So Paul's calling them to center themselves on Jesus. And following as a disciple was really, really important. A disciple wasn't just meant to have physical knowledge. As you know, probably most of you know, as we talked about in the gospel series, being a disciple meant not only did you try to think like your rabbi, but you tried to live like your rabbi. And Paul here, when he's speaking to these Gentiles, these Romans, Christians, this is actually what they thought as well. This is what Dio Chrysostom, a Greek writer and philosopher, talks about when you follow a teacher. And this is what he says. Whoever really follows anyone surely knows what that person was like, and by imitating his acts and words, he tries as best as he can to make himself like him. But that's it. That is precisely, it seems, what the pupil does. By imitating his teacher and paying heed to him, he tries to acquire his art. Paul is calling them to live out as Jesus, to live out as Paul. And it's very easy, you know, when we're going through difficult times, Tom, sometimes to think, oh, well, like that person hasn't gone through something difficult. But remember, the Philippian church, they saw Paul preach the gospel. They saw Paul live the gospel. They saw Paul go to prison for the gospel. They saw Paul in chains sharing the gospel joyfully. If you remember in Acts 16, Paul is in chains with Silas. and they're able, and God shakes the prison, and they're able to eventually go out of the prison. But they saw Paul live out the faith. Our faith is meant to be lived out, and discipleship is meant to be lived out. You know, I know we're Anabaptists here and we're Canadian here, but I want to share a story about George Washington. And I came across this story and I thought it was really interesting. It talks about, I think, living out and being an example. This is the story about George Washington. So George Washington was the commander-in-chief. And the story goes is that it was one rainy day during the American Revolutionary War. George Washington rode up to a group of soldiers attempting to raise a wooden beam to a high position. The corporal in charge was shouting encouragement, but the soldiers couldn't get the beam in position. After watching their lack of success, Washington asked the corporal, why didn't he join in and help? To which the corporal replied, don't you realize I'm the corporal? Very politely, General Washington replied, I beg your pardon, Mr. Corporal, I did. Washington dismounted his horse and went to work with his soldiers to get the oak beam in position. And as they finished, General Washington was wiped with perspiration on his face and said, if you should need help again, call on Washington, your commander-in-chief, and I will come. I wonder how that corporal felt. You know, like he didn't recognize George Washington. All of a sudden, the person who's the very leader gets down in the muck, in the mire, and is helping the soldiers, and the guy with the corporal is yelling the orders. Jesus calls us to live this way, to lead by example. Not just to think about the faith, but to also live the faith. We are called to do both. And this is how we mature. Could you imagine if Noah one day gets older and I teach him all the right theology, I teach him to think about the faith, but he never actually lives it? Has he actually matured in any way? Maturing requires both thinking and doing. These things go together. We can't do one without the other. I mean, you can, but it's not going to bring you to maturity and it's not going to bear fruit. This is what it means in part to follow Jesus. When Jesus says for us to follow him, Jesus isn't just saying, think about me. He's saying, pick up my way. Pick up the way of the cross. Will you join me in sacrificing and loving others? Jesus calls us to a radical way of sacrifice. It's in communion that we remember his sacrifice. So at this time, we're going to come to communion, and this is something very sacred, something very special that we get to do as a church. You know, the Philippian church is going through a time of hardship, a time of fracturing, a time when people were at odds with one another, and they're being persecuted. And communion was one of those things that's meant to bring us together. It's meant to make sure that we're brother and sister, even if sometimes we don't like one another. Let's be honest, I'm sure there's maybe someone here you don't like 100%. You know, but communion reminds that we are together under Jesus as Lord. And throughout the book of Philippians, you see Paul refer to Jesus as Lord countless times, over and over and over again in high density. He's wanting to join them together. And this is what communion does. And your communion recognizes that Jesus is Lord, that he's Lord above Satan, death, sin, and that he's broken the power of the enemy for us. And Jesus calls us to remember and to celebrate. I think if Paul were to think of chapter 4 and verse 8 and whatever is true, whatever is commendable, I mean, isn't communion the height of these things, remembering Jesus? It's an amazing thing to think and to dwell on and to remember Jesus. Jesus did what we could not, and he invites us to partake of his body and his blood as we participate in his victory.